We have a panel session now to take apart Australia's energy challenge. The participants in the panel are all the bio data for each of them is mentioned in the program, so I won't go through that in detail, but let me just mention and have you welcome our panellists. Firstly, Mr. John Chadwick, who's the Executive Vice President, Shell Gas and Power, who you met this morning. John Connor, the Chief Executive of the Climate Institute. Dr. Paul Simshauser, Chief Economist and Head of Corporate Affairs from AGL Energy. Dr. John Tamblyn, who is the Chairman of the Australian Energy Market Commission. And Matthew Warren on the extreme, your extreme right there, as you look at the panellists, as the Chief Executive of the Clean Energy Council. What we're going to do, well, the format is that each of our panellists will begin with a 5 to 6 minute overview. Then we'll have a sort of moderated session among the panellists. And then finally, we'll have plenty of questions, I'm sure, from the audience, fired at any or all of our panellists on different issues associated with that dual issue of energy and climate change. So, to kick things off, I'd like you to welcome, please, Mr. John Chadwick back to the podium. He will give his overview of what he believes is Australia's energy challenge. Please welcome John. And all of our panellists, please.
Today I'm going to just touch on three things. First of all, how do we see the energy challenge? And I'm going to do that from a regional and from a global perspective. Secondly, it's the importance of Australia as an energy supplier to the region. And thirdly, what we're doing as Shell to meet Australia's and the region's need. What do we think needs to be done going forward? The way that we think about the energy challenge, we put it in what we call the three hard truths. And we are convinced that these three hard truths will apply. And that drives a lot of our thinking. The first is that energy is the demand for energy is going to inexorably rise. So, yes, we're in an economic downturn at the moment. But after this downturn is finished, there will be a return to a rapid increase in the demand for energy. We believe that the demand for energy in 2050 will be very roughly twice what it is today. There are about 6 billion people in the world today. By the middle of the century, there will be about 9 billion. And a lot of the people today who don't have the security of energy that everyone in this room takes for granted, well, a lot of those in other parts of the world, they'll begin to get that energy, and it's a right that they aspire to, and they will get it. So the first one is that energy demand is going to increase. The second hard truth that we see is that energy supply is going to struggle, and increasingly struggle, to meet pace with the increasing demand. We believe that fossil fuels will take the lion's share of energy supply in the future, and it's going to become harder and harder to find and produce conventional oil and gas. I hear a lot of talk about renewables, and there's an increasing prevalence of renewables, but it will take decades, I repeat, decades, for them to become a major energy source. So the second hard truth is oil and gas, it's going to get tougher. The third hard truth in our vocabulary is that in the same time frame that energy demand will double, if we do nothing about it, CO2 production will quadruple. And that is simply unsustainable. So we support what, for example, the Australian government is trying to do, what it's trying to get through. We believe there is a need for a CPRS. Not all oil companies are of a like mind. Climate change is an issue that needs to be addressed, period. More energy, so what? If you bring all that together, what it is more energy, and what we've got to do is produce that doubling of energy with less CO2 today. And that will mean that we really have to cut our unit emissions by three quarters. Where does Australia fit in? Australia is in practically a unique position. It's very well positioned to contribute to meeting the energy challenge, and by doing so, benefit from it. It's a developed nation with a very diverse economy. It has a world-class gas resource, and there is more to find. We are big believers in the potential of gas in this country. It's also very successfully developed export markets for a wide range of its energy sources. And I can tell you, one of my responsibilities in the company is to take care of our major LNG buyers. They love Australian volumes. They really do like taking LNG from Australia. You're reliable. There's a skilled workforce here. They want security of supply, and they know they're going to get it from Australia. So while Australia will remain a net importer of crude oil and some other refined petroleum products, you can more than pay for it by your export earnings from other resources. And that puts you in a very strong position. Australia, with its population, is going to be a net exporter for many, many years. And as I said, we believe that the potential for further volumes to be discovered in Australia is very worthwhile. Shell has said it before, we spend between 12 and 15% of our annual exploration spend globally in this country. So what is Shell doing in this? How do we see ourselves fitting in? We've been in this country for over 100 years. We have been exploring in this country since 1939. We've changed quite a lot over those 100 years. But we have never been bigger, and we have never invested more than we are investing at the moment. And if I look at the next 5 years coming out, it will be very significant rates of capital investment. We currently hold about 20% of the gas resources in Australia, give or take a few percent. And we're looking at a very wide range of business opportunities, both in Western Australia and most recently in Queensland. We believe there's huge potential for the Australian energy future. We're very pleased to be part of it. I will just finish in 1 minute where we stand on the ETS, because it's probably the question I've been asked most at the fringes of this event. Number one, we support it. We support the introduction of the CPRS. Secondly, there's a few things to sort out, some details to sort out, because none of the trade partners of Australia are as well progressed as you are. The third thing that has to be removed or dealt with is the uncertainty has to be removed. The uncertainty is causing issues now, particularly for investors. And the fourth thing is what cannot happen and what cannot be allowed to happen is that the terms of the ETS change at every election cycle. That would completely undermine the credibility of the system. With that, I'll close. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. Thanks, everyone. I'm from the Climate Institute. We're a privately funded research organisation. We do research into climate impacts, community attitudes and carbon economics. I just want to make three main points this afternoon. Firstly, that in our approach to the energy challenge, we need a cost and risk-effective approach to energy policy. Secondly, that climate action is creating jobs, investments and profits right now, and will do so through this century. And that thirdly, that risk management is not just about preparing for climate impacts, but also about making sure we don't miss out on the low carbon economic train, which is already leaving the station. Firstly, it was interesting to see the IMF reports at the end of last year as we started to get into the panic about the global financial crisis, and many of us wished we could insert the words climate into that response as opposed to just financial. But it's actually quite instructive that they didn't go for a least cost only approach. They went for something which was cost and risk effective. They knew that we need investment approaches where some things may fail and other things will work, but we need urgent and solid action. So when it comes to energy supply, in our view, we need a portfolio approach to clean energy, one that aims to have a mixed portfolio of clean energy options by 2020, one in which we think the government's actually starting to get a bit closer to after developments over the last few months. We need to look at a range of clean energy options, in our view, everything from big solar, wind, indeed carbon capture and storage. We need to know whether these technologies are fully viable, and we need to know that sooner rather than later for some of them, so that they don't hang around as potential silver bullets like a bad smell for too long. We think the policy suite which combines the renewable energy target, which will drive $20 to $30 billion worth of investment, the budget with its support for big solar and for CCS, and indeed the carbon pollution reduction scheme are very important in steps towards that portfolio approach. There are issues around financing for research and development that we still need to keep an eye on, so that we actually can head towards having a range of solar, renewables, in which I have wind, biomass, geothermal in that mix, as well as CCS. From an energy usage point of view, energy efficiency policies are critical. We're starting to see some movement in that regard. Still very concerned that there's a big gap in terms of the financial incentives for existing stock in terms of our commercial built sector and also some industrial sector. So things like accelerated depreciation and others are big gaps in our energy efficiency policy. We also did a report recently on where we pulled together the statements from many of the big companies in the BCA about underneath the Energy Efficiency Opportunities Act, which highlighted that there are millions of dollars and millions of energy savings available to many of these companies, not all of which are being implemented, and many of which, in their defence, they're not doing because of the uncertainty around climate policy. Secondly, climate action creating jobs and profits. It's doing so already around the world. Worldwide, we see some 2.3 million jobs in the renewable sector, which is bigger than that employed directly in the oil and gas. In Germany, there's more employed in the manufacturing of renewables than there is of cars. And of course, here in Australia already we've got significant jobs and investments with the existing renewable policies, insulation, and indeed emissions trading. If you talk with Pack Hydro, they talk about the jobs that they're generating through investments in Chile and the like through the Clean Development Mechanism, which of course is linked to emissions trading. We did a report just recently about jobs and profit growth that we've got looking at the business proposals that are in the pipeline around Australia. If policies come through, there's some almost 30,000 jobs around Australia. If we get cracking on these climate policies, and some $30 billion worth of investment. That one conflicted with some reports from the Minerals Council, who frankly played one of the oldest cards in this climate debate in using a reduction in absolute growth under the models and saying that the relative reduction is an absolute reduction in jobs, which then they had came up with this figure of 24,000 jobs. Interesting, though, of course, was analysed by the unions themselves to say that that's actually meant in Queensland, for example, 120% still growth in jobs in Queensland. I had the pleasure of following Mitch Hook in a Senate inquiry recently, and under questioning he admitted that we know we will continue to grow, quote unquote. So frankly, I think scandalous scaremongering that's been going on, and it's been very interesting to see the Fin Review, and indeed I saw that many of those companies are now going to be asked to explain why their public comments are so different from their comments to their shareholders before the ACCC. So there's room to go on that. Look, and just finally relatedly, in terms of risk management, in terms about how we're preparing, It's about preparing not just for impacts already upon us in terms of climate risks or those which are clearly predictable. And a very interesting front page story today that the Newcastle coal facilities are planning for significant sea level rises, that the new ones they're building there. But it's actually about not missing out on these economic opportunities which are there and growing around the world right now. We're seeing the US, we're seeing China, South Korea all investing significantly in these sectors, and they're not doing it just as a short-term thing, they're doing it as a long-term thing. I'll leave it at that. We can come back to some further questions later, but I think it's important in this debate that business gets out there and gets action going here. We've got enough of politicians just arguing about this stuff, and business really has no more excuse for inaction. Thank you.
And now, Paul Simshauser.
Being a propeller head economist, I had to come with some graphs. It just wouldn't be the same otherwise. In terms of Australia's energy challenge, I thought I'd just start with a quick graph that runs through the long-run marginal cost of utility-scale power plants. And this graph, it's the first time I've ever done it this way, but I've started with a CO2 price in rather than without, because we need to start getting used to that. For those who can't read the bottom axis there, or for that matter the y-axis, it's dollars per megawatt hour starting from zero up to $160 a megawatt hour on that y-axis. And along the bottom there is all the various generating plant technologies. And the lowest there is actually a combined cycle gas turbine at $3.50 a gigajoule for gas. Hands up anyone who thinks that gas will cost $3.50 a gigajoule in a handful of years' time. I didn't think so. So if you move further along the graph, in fact, about fifth from the end, you'll see where it is at $7.50 a gigajoule. All of those power plants are basically starting at around the $70 a megawatt hour and moving north, and historically we've been buying power for around 35 to 40 at the wholesale level. So there's a pretty big step change involved in our power prices in this country. And their CO2 emission footprints measured on the right-hand axis. The challenges for us, though, aren't really going to be so much in terms of price. It's going to be in adding capacity and in financing that capacity. This table here at the bottom just highlights the plant that we have currently on the east coast of Australia, segregated into their various portfolio duties. So we have base load plant, intermediate peaking plant, then the renewables fleet and some embedded generation. And you'll see at the bottom there, it's around about a 42,900 megawatts of installed capacity, and that represents a plant stock of around about $53 billion. That's the optimal, and the actual is sort of 45,300. And you'll see for the first time in over 10 years, our plant portfolio is just about exhausted. So for all of the last sort of 10 or 12 years that we've had the national electricity market in place, we have always been oversupplied with generating plant. And for the first time, we're starting to run into a situation where right around the grids, no matter any of the states and indeed over in Western Australia, the plant stock is largely exhausted. At the moment, we have an oversupply of 2,400 megawatts. Last summer, demand across the East Coast actually increased by 2,400 megawatts. So it would only take one more summer like that, and we're basically in balance for the first time a simultaneous shortage across the power grid. In terms of what's required to keep our industry rolling forward, over the course of the next 5 years, around about $118 billion needs to be invested in refinancing existing power stations, refinancing existing energy networks, capital expenditure on new and existing power plant and new networks, and the initial capital required to purchase emission permits. $118 billion is a huge amount of money. The expanded renewable energy target will also add to that requirement going forward. This graph here, just on the y-axis, I have gigawatt hours ranging from zero up to about 70,000. And along the bottom axis there is 1997-8 through to 2030. That first line there shows you the pre-1997 renewable generation output. So that's effectively from all the old hydro plants, from Snowy Hydro, from Tasmania Hydro and all the other bits and pieces that comprise the pre-1998 renewables fleet. We then stepped up the original mandatory renewable energy target, which was adding effectively 2% of capacity to the grid, so around about 9,500 gigawatt hours. At the time, for those who can remember it, it was considered almost an undoable target. Most of us in the industry had absolutely no idea how we were going to shake the renewables tree and land with 9,500 gigawatt hours of extra generating capacity. Well, these dot points, if I can get them to pop up, as it turns out, magically, the industry got there, and it always does. The one thing about our industry, you put it, give it a Pepsi challenge, it'll usually rise to the fourth. We then added our expanded renewable energy target, and of course that's scheduled to go through the upper house next week, and it sort of got expanded at the last minute, which I think everyone was pleased. That will no doubt mean that the investment task going forward will be a little bit easier to digest from a financing perspective. In terms of what that means for new generating capacity around Australia, what I've got here is two forecasts. On the y-axis, installed capacity, or the new capacity required in power station capacity in megawatts, and you can see that runs from zero to about 20,000. And I've got two forecasts here. One that was done in 2006, when prior to the 20% renewable target being in existence, and then one in 2009, so the after effect. And it's an outlook between 2010 and 2020 of what's actually required. So we were thinking back in 2006 we'd need a little bit of coal, mostly combined cycle baseload gas turbine plant, around 5,500 megawatts, about 4,500 megawatts in gas turbine peaking capacity, and a little bit of renewables. You can see in 2009 that picture's changed very dramatically. A little bit of coal, a little bit of baseload gas, a lot of peaking plant to deal with the intermittency and the weather-dependent nature of renewable capacity, and then about 9,500 megawatts of new renewable capacity. And the differential in the investment profiles between those two scenarios, first case about $17 billion, second case $32 billion. Australia in and of itself relies extremely heavily on foreign debt. On this graph here, I just have on the left-hand axis the foreign capital that comes into our country to invest across all industries. And you can see from 2001 through to 2008, it sort of ramped up pretty hardly in 2006, 7, 8 onwards. And that's the split between equity at the bottom and debt at the top. In 2005, it seemed there was a big withdrawal of equity and still a lot of debt coming in. But just to give you an idea of what that means, so over the past few years, we've been bringing in around about $165 billion worth of capital from foreign markets. That's represented over 60% of all capital invested on the ground across all industries. So we're critically reliant on foreign capital for us to do what we need to do in our country, whatever industry it is you're from. One of the difficulties I see at the moment is that a number of those foreign banks and those foreign investment funds are no more. There's a huge number of those banks that have been financing fixed assets. And bear in mind, too, the power industry, or the energy industry more broadly, is the world's most capital-intensive industry. Nothing comes close. It's the world's biggest industry. And in addition to that, the power industry in and of itself is the third largest user of debt capital, behind governments, number one, and behind the banking community, number two. So number three is the power industry in terms of debt use. And in terms of what's happening in debt markets, as you'd all be aware, they have been freezing up. Everyone says they're thawing. We're still kind of not seeing it yet. But 2006, you can see their total debt issuance. So this graph here shows you total debt issued around the globe in US dollars in 06, 07, 08, and up to the first part of the quarter of 09. And you can see in 06 it was around about $2.8 trillion, and it was thundering along pretty hard in 2007 until the CDO market collapsed in the United States, at which point the debt market started to decelerate by around about 32% in the third quarter and 65% in the fourth quarter. In 2008, the market was again down probably 50% on the previous year, and the Lehman collapse actually froze the market altogether, and you can see that in that third quarter there. And consequently, debt margins in the marketplace have been repriced very significantly. This graph here just shows you historic interest rates between 2000 and 2008. The thick orange line there shows you basically a 10-year swap, which is typically associated with capital-intensive investments. Behind that is the bill and bond rates. And at the bottom there is the actual corporate spreads that are placed on top of those instruments, which then manifest themselves in the headline rate of interest that business actually uses in its investment cases. And you'll see there that while the swap rate actually plunged very significantly, spreads have gone to levels that just historically haven't been seen before. And currently, right now, I guess, you know, you'd be doing well to get anything below about 400 bips in the marketplace, and certainly for a project financing of anything in the energy industry would be a miraculous outcome. Probably the other material aspect is terms. Historically, you'd be chasing a 10, 12-year term facilities. Right now, 5 years is the most you'll get. What does that mean? Well, it means that the overall refinancing risk associated with fixed capital assets has been heightened very materially. So one of the predictable outcomes from that will be that you'll see a deleveraging. We're seeing that for a whole range of reasons, and I've got a good slide on that next. But the main thing is, in terms of project economics for all power applications and energy applications going forward, there will be a re-rating overall of the risk profile of those businesses on their costs of capital. Now, if you're clever enough to use the capital asset pricing model, it'll actually tell you it's going down. But what you've demonstrated to me is that you can read a textbook, and for that I'd congratulate you. But if you go around and look at any financing right now, if you go and look at the ASX listing infrastructure stocks, shake out all the rest and look at what's happening with the dividend yields on all of that, all the running yields on all that, all those stocks, currently up 230 basis points. So what that's telling you is that at the very least, the cost of equity capital has gone up by 230 basis points, and a capital asset pricing model will tell you that it's gone down. So again, that's we see as a material issue. And corporate Australia is going very hard right now at deleveraging balance sheets. This is the capital raisings since 1990 through to 2009, and you can see what's happening because of the freezing up of debt markets. We're hitting the equity capital markets harder than we've ever hit them before, and in fact, at the end of this year, we expect it'll be something like 7 or 8% of market capitalisation has been raised in discrete financings, and the overwhelming majority of those, as you can see from that orange bar there, is in secondary raisings. By the end of this process, corporate Australia will have de-geared its balance sheets from around about 40% down to 31% or thereabouts is the expectation, which are sort of eerily similar numbers to the 1991-93 credit cycle. The other thing I'd just add in terms of if we get over that, once you get your head around those capital constraint issues and the cost of capital, we are operating in a global market. This graph here just shows you investment in renewable energy capacity. And you can see here, around in 2008, despite the nature of the markets or the state of credit markets, about $159 billion was invested globally in renewable energy capacity. And if I can read on my screen here, you can probably see it better. As I recall, thermal applications were $175 billion. So across the globe, in 1 year, and in one of the worst sort of years in terms of investment in memory, $333 billion went into power-generating applications across the globe. And somehow or other, we need to make sure that our policy settings are put in the context of that environment, that we are able to attract the foreign capital, be it the debt and the equity markets. We certainly don't do enough savings, so we're always going to be reliant on those foreign flows, and we're competing in a very big world. And I hasten to add, you'll see those first two bars there, they're not third-world countries. You know, it's the EU's 27 and the US. So in summary, 10 years of oversupply, the NEM's now balanced, and given the growth of 2 to 3% per annum, significant investments required. The investment task is very substantial by Australian standards, $118 billion in refinancings across the supply chain, $32 billion in addition to that in terms of new power generation and much of that renewable capacity. About 61% of our capital comes from foreign sources. Debt markets are constrained and risk has been materially repriced. The equity capital market's being tapped as hard as they possibly can, and global power investments topped $333 billion. So we are competing in a global market for that capital.
Dr. John Tamblyn from the Energy Market Regulator.
Thank you very much, David, and good afternoon, everybody. Now, as always, Paul Simhauser is a very hard act to follow. I too will be talking about the Australian power industry, and I hope I can put some of his very detailed comments into a broader perspective. I want to focus on the challenges facing the Australian electricity industry. My main focus will be on the impact of climate change policy, but I'll touch on a few of the other challenges facing the industry, and I think Paul touched on those as well. I think it's important, by the way, to emphasise that the Australian electricity industry is very significant in the challenges facing energy for our country. it's a very significant, important input into business and commerce. It's a very important source of the competitiveness of the Australian economy, and it's a very important contributor to the household sector and its lifestyle and welfare. So it's a very important sector, but it's also critical to the success or not of climate change policy, assuming we see that legislation pass the House. So that's why I want to focus on it. Some of the challenges currently facing the industry include the following. We've seen very rapid growth, particularly in peak demand. It has been driven particularly by the growth of air conditioners in our household sector, but also by the prevalence of some more extreme weather events, particularly at summertime in recent times. And until recently, it's also been driven by strong economic growth. So demand has been growing rapidly. We've also seen a very severe tightening of the supply-demand balance in the power sector, and I think Paul touched on that as well. This has been partly the result of the effectiveness of the reform agenda in the sector, where we've now got down to a fairly efficient balance of supply and demand. But there's also been a degree of policy uncertainty overhanging the industry, partly to do with climate change policy and the progress there, but also the global financial crisis as well has contributed. So we're seeing something of a slowdown in investment at a time when demand has been continuing to grow. There's a very significant new investment requirement in the sector, and Paul also touched on that very large investment requirement. It's driven by the need for significant replacement investment of ageing equipment, both in the transmission sector but also the generation sector, but also to respond to the growth in demand. And of course, as I'll touch on, climate change policy will also bring with it a very significant investment requirement for the power sector to transform to a low carbon status. The global financial crisis raises a problem for financing that very significant investment load. And of course, then the changes to the sector driven by climate change policy are challenges as well. And it's really the latter that I would like to touch on in the remainder of my remarks. As I said, the power sector is very critical to the success of climate change policy. As Penny Wong said this morning, currently 80% of our electric power is driven by coal generation, a further 11% by gas, and the balance at the moment is renewables. Up to 50% of our total emissions are from the stationary energy sector, so clearly changing that emission performance in the power sector is going to be very important to climate change policy. The focusing question that I want to raise, and I must say the Australian Energy Market Commission is currently doing a review of this matter for the Ministerial Council on Energy. The focusing question is, will the current electricity market design support the very major transformation that climate change policy will drive while still keeping the lights on, driving the power supply required by industry and the household sector? Or do we need to make changes to the market design to better facilitate that very significant transition? Some of the likely impacts of climate change policy on the power sector, which you'll be well aware of. First of all, there'll be major change in the generation technologies, probably a strong move from coal to gas-fired and renewables. That new technology is likely to be located in different parts of the country compared to the strong coal-based generation at the moment. We'll therefore see major changes in the flow of power across the current transmission network, and we're likely to see congestion in the weaker parts of the network, and we may well see spare capacity in the currently stronger parts of the network, which are bringing power from the coal fields, or the coal-based generation. There'll also be challenges for connection to the transmission network if we see much more remotely located renewable generation in the form of geothermal, wind, solar and so on. So there'll be very significant pressures on the transmission network, as well as the dramatic changes in the generation sector. There are also potential risks because of the uncertain profile of exit over time in the medium term of the emission-intensive generation and the entry of the low-emission technologies. As I said, we want to keep the lights on through this very important transformation, and ensuring that exit and entry are well-balanced is going to be another challenge for the power sector. We'll also see higher and potentially more volatile wholesale and retail prices for energy, and that will have implications for competition in the power sector at the retail end. It'll have implications for the cost structures of industry and commerce, and it'll have implications for the budgets of the household sector. So these are quite profound changes to the power sector to be driven by climate change policy. How has the energy market performed to date? Well, as Paul just said, it has proved to be very efficient and effective at attracting the investment and the capital to keep supply and demand in balance over time. We have very competitive wholesale and retail markets at the moment. We also have relatively efficient, I think very efficient actually, economic regulation of the monopoly network sector. This has facilitated the right level of investment into the market and cost-reflective pricing in the market. So the performance to date has been sound and effective. Reliability has been maintained. Significant investment has been attracted to the sector, and we've seen prices that reflect the resource costs. So that gives us reasonably strong confidence that the market mechanisms we have and the economic regulation framework should be equal to the task of managing this transition. Nevertheless, I think we do need to look at what are the risks, where are the areas where the market framework may not be as effective as possible, and other options for change. So let me just close my remarks on that level. There are a number of risks which we have identified at the Commission where we think there could be and should be some changes to the market design. The first one is management of reliability of supply in the short term. As I mentioned, there will be pressures on the emission-intensive generation technologies to exit the industry over time. There will also be a carbon price incentive for renewables to enter. We want to make sure that there isn't early exit and delayed entry, and so that is a challenge. To assist in managing reliability in the short term, we are proposing improvements to the system operators' capacity to elicit capacity from the marketplace if there is a shortfall, and also looking at mechanisms to raise the price cap in the wholesale market to better encourage investment in the short term. I've mentioned as well the pressure on the transmission network. We are looking to improved price signals for the network to give a better incentive for entry in the least congested parts of the network and a disincentive for entry into the congested parts of the network. The issues we're looking at is whether generators should pay network charges. Currently, they do not. We're also looking at whether a price signal could not be introduced into the wholesale market to reflect congestion. We're also looking at transmission charges across regions. At the moment, transmission prices are settled within each individual state in the union. If it's the case, South Australia, for example, sees a lot of wind generation enter, and they're exporting a lot of power to Victoria and New South Wales. Victoria and New South Wales could be asked to pay some of the transmission charges levied in South Australia currently to move that power across the country. We're also looking at the question of improved arrangements for connection of remote generation be it wind, geothermal or solar, to the shared network. So that's another issue that I can talk about later if people are interested. We also think there will be some pressure on the retail market and retailers, because in a number of jurisdictions we still regulate retail prices for the household sector. At a time when prices are going to be increasing and they're likely to be more volatile prices, the risk of regulated prices getting out of line with the real cost of providing electricity will put pressure on retailer viability and may prevent the consumers from seeing the price signal they're intended to see. There are a number of areas which I'll close on where we think the market will perform well and probably doesn't need change. We think reliability in the long term can be maintained by the energy-only market and the price signals it gives, provided the price cap that currently applies to that market is lifted to ensure that the price signal is always sufficient to provide incentive for the right level of investment. So we think in the long term that market performance will be fine. Managing intermittent generation on a larger scale in the market can introduce problems for system management. If wind generation is dropping off quickly when the wind stops blowing, coming on when the wind starts to blow, that can be very difficult for the system operator to keep the system in balance, but we think the arrangements currently in place can manage that. And I think that's about all I'll say. So there are many other issues there that I could comment on in questions, but that's a broader overview of our current thinking about the capacity of the power market to manage the important pressures that climate change policy will put on it. Thank you for listening to me.
Matthew Warren from the Clean Energy Council.
Thanks, David. Just to summarise or introduce the Clean Energy Council, for those who don't know, it's the peak body for Australia's clean energy and energy efficiency industry, representing about 400 companies. I've also got 3 points that I'd like to sort of quickly touch on today and try and stay under the time constraints. The first point, I suppose, is to take a slightly different approach to the other speakers. Environmental problems have been misdiagnosed for the last generation. So what we're discussing here in terms of reform of the energy market is fundamentally an environmental problem. Environmental harm on any substantive scale is not deliberate. It's an accidental byproduct of wealth generation. No one means to harm the environment when they build a power station or conduct other business for its own sake. There are rare exceptions. Now, overlaying that with the origins of the environmental policy debate globally, no one really cared too much about the environment except for the protest movement in about the 1960s and 70s. Now, we're grateful that they cared, but they cast it as their understanding of the world was as a moral dilemma. And so from the protest movement's perspective, it was a campaign against a polluter, a campaign against a company, a country, an individual. Now, what we're realising is that process is not sustainable in the modern debate, because you can't solve an economic problem with a moral construct. And that's led to this sort of demonisation and punishment sort of paradigm, which has run shotgun with a lot of the environmental policy debate, but we don't think that's a sustainable way of thinking about the problem. It's also worth just remembering that the reason why we have the challenges of increased energy use is because we use energy as a substitute for labour. And the process of increased productivity in our economy and increased mechanisation and industrialisation has made our workplaces safer and cleaner and faster and more efficient and more profitable, and generated the wealth that we enjoy today, the wealth we're going to need in order to invest in the solutions. The second, just focusing on the issue at hand, is the energy transformation that we're talking about is the challenge of decarbonising the global energy supply. I've been trying to think of any policy challenge in living memory, certainly in modern history, that compares to the scale of what we're attempting to undertake. It is an extraordinary nature. It's an unconventional problem, And alluding to some of my colleagues' presentations, I would suggest that the only way you can possibly solve an unconventional problem is with unconventional thinking. If you try and address this in the conventional way that we would address such problems, you will, you know, you're doomed to fail. The reason why it's such a challenge is that it's not only a large-scale problem with the overlay of developing economies seeking to improve the lot of their populace by using energy to substitute for labour and drive wealth, but it's time-constrained. We can't let this process evolve and see what happens and accept the outcome. We have to force the outcome. We have to force the process. And that is problematic because there is a high degree of uncertainty in the solution. We don't know what the solution looks like. We don't know how much it's going to cost. It particularly relates to the sector that I represent in clean energy and energy efficiency, but it also relates to the deploy of clean coal, if it works, how much it costs, and other technologies in the space. So we don't know this, but the International Energy Agency projects that 78% of global greenhouse emission reductions by 2050 will come from energy efficiency and from renewable energy. So that's more than two-thirds. And yet we don't know what they look like, we don't know how much they'll cost. And I suggest that this challenges the conventional economic theory that we apply, because in everything I'm seeing, that it's not sufficient to deal with the problem at hand. The third issue I'd like to sort of say, the solution to this comes from innovation, and innovation both in policy design and innovation in technology. There was an interesting edition of the New Yorker magazine released last month, which had essays discussing the nature of innovation. And one of them argued that we always think of innovation as being driven by scarcity, but it's not. It's driven by abundance. And the example they gave was the invention of the mousetrap. You know, the saying being, build a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. But the mousetrap wasn't invented until long after, you know, rodents had been driven out of European cities from improved sewage systems. It was only when people had time to worry about the problem that they crafted an ever-increasingly ingenious set of solutions to kill mice. And I think the same applies in this policy debate. You only have to look at the last 12 months and the nature of the debate over a CPRS. Just the threat of scarcity of that scale has driven most of Australia's industry to fight to protect its assets and its wealth under that threat of scarcity. There's been not much talk of deploying and reinvesting. It's all been about extracting special deals and special circumstances for different industries, as you would expect them to do. By comparison, I draw the analogy of the recently terminated solar PV rebate, which ended last week. We had a presentation from Minister Peter Garrett on Friday, who indicated that the scheme in its entirety had cost $700 million. Just to update those who are not familiar with it, there's been a rebate provided to installers of solar PV panels in Australia of about $4,000. This was doubled in 2007 during the election campaign to $8,000, which would be considered by most economists to be one of the most generous forms of government subsidy provided in this space. Now, I don't think it was intended by this, but what that has had the effect of doing is transforming the solar PV industry. We've seen the arrival of a range of new entrants into the market who have taken a long-term, large-scale approach. They've bought panels in bulk, they've bought inverters at bulk, they've worked out how to drive down the cost of deploying these panels by 30-50%. With the end of that scheme, they're not packing up their boxes and going home. They're working out how they can deploy panels to more households under a more modest scheme. So it does suggest that we've benefited enormously from that investment, even though it was completely unforeseen. And to that end, we obviously support the deploy of the renewable energy targets of 20% by 2020, because we don't know what it's going to do, and that's the point. First of all, we've got to get that legislation right, and we've been working pretty hard in the last couple of weeks to do that. But second, we obviously see that kind of policy as being a foundation for other challenges. As other speakers have pointed out, we have colossal challenges finding $28 billion to deploy and invest the technologies required, as well as upgrading the grid and the networks. And finally, I suppose just to say that some of the barriers to, in terms of unconventional thinking, aren't conventional. And the The Rudd government recently in February announced, as part of its economic stimulus package, generous incentives to deploy insulation and solar hot water technologies as part of that measure, which is welcome. They've allocated strong incentives for insulation, estimating there are 2 million households that don't have it. But the truth is we don't even know how many households don't have adequate insulation in Australia. But I can guarantee you that most of the households that don't also don't have one other key piece of technology. It's called a ladder. And whether or not it might have been better for the Commonwealth to deploy ladders around Australia so we could find out which households need insulation as opposed to just giving extra money to do so. With solar hot water, we think the problem is practical, is that the day your hot water system runs out, the first thing you do is order another hot water system that fits in quickly and gives you hot water the next day. So we suggest that maybe households in Australia need a hot water plan so that, just like a bushfire plan, when your hot water system breaks down, you already know the optimal technology that should be going into your dwelling and you can deploy it immediately. So they're the nature of the challenges in our space, but we think it's a great opportunity to transform and revitalise the energy networks in Australia. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Matthew, and thanks to all of our panellists. Trying to pick out some themes out of all of that, I think if I could probably start just with this general theme of meeting the growing demand for energy. Each of you have commented in your own particular way about that. And also that issue of trying to finance that increasing demand for energy. Before we go to the power generation sector, perhaps if I could just get a comment from you, John. I had read that the International Energy Association had forecast something like a 21% reduction in capital expenditure in the oil and gas industry on new projects because of the global financial crisis. What kinds of... is that an assessment you agree with, and are you seeing some difficulties coming through even into the oil and gas industry from the financial crisis?
I think a lot has been said in the media about the reduction in demand. Where there has been a lot less said is about the reduction in investment for long-term supply. And we are concerned that if there is an upturn in the coming years, as we predict there will be sometime during the next decade, it could be that there is a much greater supply shortage than we saw last year. And there is a number of reasons for that. There's less capital. The finance companies that before previously relied on financing, recourse and non-recourse, are finding that financing tougher to get, and if they can get it, they have more encumbrances to deal with. And you're seeing that some of the smaller players in the large integrated energy projects at the moment are struggling to make those investments. So while in the near term the shortage of demand is an issue, there could be a much bigger problem in 4 or 5 years down the road where there is a shortage of supply as a result of the cutbacks today. We actually agree with numbers not dissimilar to what the IEA is saying about reduction in capital expenditure this year. And on all of that reduction is because costs have come down. One of the realities we are dealing with in our business today is that oil prices are back to the 2004 level, about. Costs are way above the 2004 level. So the unit cost of doing our business is much higher than it was in the past. And that's stopping investments proceeding. Governments have got to be wary of that. They've got to somehow work with industry to make sure that those major projects can go ahead. Just one final word, if I may, I'm going to take an example. Gorgon, the minister was right this morning when he talked about the financial dimensions. The capital investment there from three private companies, and I'll be open with you, we are one of them, is bigger than the dimensions of Australia's fiscal stimulus package. But the reason one of the key reasons we're investing is because it's in Australia. Don't forget that. It's a secure, reliable place for us to do business, and it's a place where buyers, energy buyers, like dealing with. And that will be a huge job creator. It'll be a project for 60 years plus.
It's a win-win-win all around. And the size of the geosequestration project is five times bigger than the second largest sequestration project in the world. Huge advertisement for Australia. Thank you.
And just going then to the power generation sector, both Paul and John, you talked very much there about the impact of the global financial crisis, but also the impact, therefore, of addressing climate change on attracting that kind of investment into the energy sector. So what kind of impact are you seeing, for example, as you look at the renewable energy target, the 20% by 2020, what kind of impact is that going to have on the most efficient sort of forms of investment in power generation? Do you want to take that first, Paul?
Yeah, look, I think from a power supply side perspective, probably one of the few bright spots right now is actually the renewable market. And the reason for that is, and fingers crossed, we'll have some legislation sort of making its way through the upper house next week. I guess from a business perspective, there's certainty over those investments in the marketplace, and that legislation will tie the knot on that. And that's important. We can deal with commodity price uncertainty. We can deal with variable prices of RECs. What we can't deal with is rules of the game that are unknown, i.e. CPRS in its current form.
John, did you want to... John Tamworth?
Yes, look, I would just comment on how do we deal with responding to rapidly growing demand in the power sector. There's a demand side and a supply side answer to this question, and I think it's fair to say the demand side is still very underdeveloped in our power sector, and we tend to drive more investment on the supply side to meet growing demand. So I'd certainly make the point that with the prospect of interval meters that can measure usage on time of day and therefore price time of day, and with the advent of smart grids where there can be interactive management of demand so that consumers can agree that the system operator or the distributor can turn off their power or turn down their air conditioner or their pool pump at times of peak demand when prices are high, that will give much more opportunity for the demand side to be managed, particularly at peak times. On the other side of this, however, when the market is under most pressure, is on those very, very hot days when demand is very high and we have very expensive peak capacity standing by to be used 50 or 100 hours during the year. That's very expensive use of capacity, but the community demands on those hot days that the lights don't go off. So we have to have the right price incentives and remuneration for that peak power to be there at the times when it's needed. I was saying in my remarks, I think the pricing signals that are given through the wholesale market are going to be sufficient to deliver that peak power, and we have the flexibility to raise the price cap to do that. But my main response, I think, is we've got much more work to do on the demand side of the market, and we need to do that.
If I can just continue with that theme with John Connor and Matthew. The renewable energy target, I mean, I take it from your remarks that both of you are very much in favour of that as at least some form of complement to the emissions trading scheme, the CPRS. But why do you think both are necessary? First you, John.
The CPRS will drive medium to long-term investment signals it's very important in our view that we get cracking. I think I tried to make the point that we do have there's a valley of death, a valley of uncertainty about some of these technologies we need to get through. We need to get them through them in the next 10 years. And so we need policies that drive these technologies forward. We actually think that if you combine emissions trading and the renewable energy target with the CPRS, it's actually the cheaper, with an emissions trading scheme, it's actually the cheaper way to go in the long term. And we've had McClellan Magazinex and Associates do some modelling for us on that. The interaction of the renewable energy sector with the pool price and things like that, and the obvious thing on demand management in terms of the cheapest power plant's the one you don't build. So those things are very important. So that's why we're strong backers of that. Getting into policy detail, but we are worried about solar hot waters, heat pump, as cannibalising that thing and not sending clear enough signals into that space.
Matthew.
Oh, look, just to add to that, we probably argue that energy efficiency and policies to deploy clean energy and drive down the cost should precede a carbon price. That was the intent of the MRET in 2001 and the findings of the peer review in 2003. So ideally you want to know what you've got to play with when you start putting a price on carbon. Unfortunately, we're not in that position. So we see that the faster we can get the RET deployed, the easier it'll be for the market to determine what its face is under a full carbon price.
If I can just throw that question then back to Paul Simshauser, your business, of course, you have a very strong gas business, and I've heard it said within the power sector that effectively the impact of the renewable energy target is that it means that if you're trying to reduce emissions, gas is the alternate which is ready now and available now and can be used. By mandating the use of renewable energy, what it means is that the next most efficient alternate gets ruled out in an economic equation.
Yeah, I know the argument. Oh, well. look, I guess my... House view is that if you go to any Western economy around the world right now, they've got a three-pronged approach to dealing with the greenhouse issue, and it invariably comes down to an emissions trading scheme or a variant thereof, a renewable energy target, and an energy efficiency scheme for all the reasons that the guys have just mentioned, and I don't think you can get away from that as good policy. It's just good policy. It's as simple as that. If you load all of your irons into the one fire, then it's just a great risk you're going to get it wrong. And I don't think anyone in this room can stand up and say they've got the silver bullet yet. So on that basis, good policy really does mean let's go and shake every tree we can and shake it as hard as we think we can. And from our perspective, I mean, we think the 20% target, it's a steep target. But we were saying 2% was steep 10 years ago and we got there. So, I mean, I guess our view is... We're not sure quite how yet, but we're confident we'll get there in the end.
Could I just add one consequence of the ERET, which is going to drive wind as the available renewable in the short term, is there needs to be backup generation to keep the power supply online when the wind is not blowing. And so that implies that there's got to be some baseload capacity. It's likely to be gas that needs to be there to back up the wind. That's not to say the policy isn't a good policy, but you do need to have supporting generation to support intermittent generation which will come into the market.
I think also too, David, and the point that Matthew made before was an important one. If all we did was a CPRS policy in our country, investors in our industry are going to go after the low-hanging fruit, which would be the gas-fired generation. But the consequence of that is that we're going to have another 10 years of delayed activity on renewables, and quite honestly, we need to be pressing on all those technologies to try and get them down their cost curves as fast as we can. And for anyone who's seen the experience cost curve, the actual historic cost curve of wind farms, it explains pretty clearly why you need to do this. If you actually take the cost of wind back in 1978, the first sort of reasonable scale wind farm was $325 a megawatt hour, and by the time we finished plotting it, it was in the mid 70s. So it's come a long way. And for every doubling of a technology's capacity, as a simple rule of thumb, you'll get a cost decrease of about 20%.
Yes, Matthew.
I was just going to answer to John's point because it illustrates what we're talking about with unconventional thinking. You know, for 100 years, because of the nature of our generation assets, we've designed a grid and designed a sort of an electricity market about large-scale, stable generation capacity and variable demand. Now, what we're approaching is a change to that, where we've got to change our thinking. We've got increased variability in supply matching increased variability in demand. Now, it doesn't automatically hold. We have to try and recreate the market conditions that we've run for 100 years because it might be more expensive than finding other ways of managing the demand to match the supply. And that's, the wind blows at different times, the sun shines at different times, but they still create their own peaks and demands that just have to be managed in a different way. So it's not assuming we just try and recreate what we've already got as being the answer every time. The idea of nighttime off-peak pricing as an example may be abandoned for afternoon off-peak pricing because it might be the cheapest time to buy electricity.
If I can just get a perspective here from John Chadwick on my left here, even if you like from a regional perspective, John, if the game of the name of the game is trying to reduce emissions, though, why wouldn't we be trying to have all the right incentives in place for gas because it's available now?
Yeah, so it's a difficult question to answer, this one. Gas is the cleanest fossil fuel today. This country is blessed with huge volumes of gas that is transportable, is wanted by the most dynamic, the most growing energy market in the world, Northeast Asia. My belief is also, and I think the pundits will back, the most efficient power generation today remains combined cycle gas-fired power generation. We actually, as a company, Shell, support not only the CPRS, but also establishing a fixed target for the introduction of renewable energies. Because if you don't do that, the efficiencies, the thermodynamics of combined cycle gas-fired generation will win. So we're in the renewables business as well, by the way, so it's something that we're promoting. Today, the reality is that most renewable energies will not compete with that. You're taking, quite correctly, a very Australian view. In many other parts of Asia, competitive dynamic is even tougher. And the reason for that is your government's more alert to it here than in other parts of the region.
Well, if we can just switch subject now to the CPRS, just to get some quick reactions on the CPRS. Of course, and we heard the Minister say this morning, that Penny Wong, that effectively it was to drive a market-based solution. Can I ask you, John, do you see it that way? Is it a market-based solution?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a very important signal, particularly into the medium and long term, to drive innovation and drive investment for the capital stock replacement tasks that we have across many of our sectors, and to continue growth, as so much of the modelling shows. So it's a vital tool in our books, but it's one that needs supplement by good policy on energy efficiency, and I'm glad to hear this chorus of accord here for renewable and other policies as well.
I just want to press you a bit on that, you know, as the panel again, as you really look at the purpose of it, though, which is to effectively take its place in trying to drive the investment certainty. When you think about the elements of the CPRS, do you really have a scheme which is going to drive that investment investment certainty over the long term?
John first, and perhaps...
Yeah, just... it's not a perfect scheme. We've been through quite a storm of political fighting and argy-bargy. I mean, but I don't think... So, for example, we have a... clearest price signals for around 40% of the economy, even though the thing has 70% coverage. We've got petrol excise offsets, we've got a whole range of other things. Again, while we need stronger complementary policies, but I'm not of the camp that says let's scrap it, because it's going to take another 2 or 3 years to get something back up again at the very quickest. So I think it's enough. We need to keep working on that.
Paul, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I think if you put all the pieces of paper representing all the inquiries that we've done in this country on emissions trading, it'd stand about this high. In fact, the last Senate inquiry I went to, I was very tempted to take it all in there with me and pile it all on the one desk, dating back from that first set of discussion papers from the AGO in 1999. My sense is, look, there are things about the scheme that, you know, each various industry groups want to see changed. I think taking it out and making wholesale changes will set us back dreadfully. I can assure you that the banks and the equity investors didn't just all of a sudden stop including it in their forward forecast just because the opposition sort of said it sort of seems like we need to go back to a drawing board. The problem we've got now is that we've got a bunch of or the investment community second-guessing what the government will actually do, and I think that's much worse than actually just getting something out on the table. Again, give people the rules of the game. We'll always be able to work out with the uncertainty that sits within it.
Well, perhaps one final question before we turn it over to the audience. Carbon pollution reduction scheme, or generically emissions trading scheme versus tax? Which one do you favour and why? John?
What are we trying to achieve here? Are we trying to achieve a reduction in emissions, or are we trying to raise tax income? The CPRS, the cap and trade approach, gives the incentive and let the market set the price. And the best performers, the lowest unit emitters, will win more. Tax is not the way forward. And I know there's some that disagree in the audience here, but let's be clear as to the objectives of the CPRS, and let's come up with a scheme that actually delivers on that objective.
Any other? I just think those who think that tax is somehow going to be simpler or politically easier haven't seen what's happened to tax policy in the last 100 years.
I think if we, as long as we keep the unlimited import of CERs, we're effectively getting a tax anyway. We just, in the context of an emissions trading regime, so you kind of get the best of both worlds. The market essentially sets it rather than someone trying to second guess it, but it should be a stable enough and a predictable enough number reflecting a tax rate, provided we do, that unlimited importation of CERs remains intact as that piece of legislation goes follows its path wherever it ends up.
I'll pass on this question. Thank you very much.
Matthew.
Look, we don't care, but we do think we should just get started. And I think the key word on any policy design we said is flexibility. We're probably going to be debating this for the next decade. And we liken the whole process to buying a computer. You can always wait 2 years. There's always a better model coming, and you should always wait for the upgrade. But if you never buy one, you don't know what you need and how it's going to work and what you really want and what you don't want. So if you start, at least, in a way you can get bipartisan support, you can find out what you really need to do and improve over time.
All right, it sounds like our panellists, at least, except for me, are in favour of a CPRS, but let's see if the audience agrees. Is there any questions? It doesn't have to be on that issue, of course.
Martin Albrecht from Geodynamics. It's to you, John, and it isn't related to tax versus CPRS. You made the comment, and it's very heartening to think that we'll have $50 billion invested in Australia. It poses the other question that the reason why people are attracted to invest here is because of our sovereign risk profile. What has been going on, obviously, across the planet is a transformation in ownership from the large oil companies to sovereign ownership of the carbon resources. How do you see that playing out in the next 20 years? Because to me, that poses a very fundamental question about the whole equilibrium of energy and how you plan for that.
Thank you. It's not just because of the low sovereign risk that that Australia attracts investment fund. You've got a highly skilled workforce. You've got a government that people can talk to most of the time. So Australia doesn't have a national oil company. And I actually think it's a winner as a result of that decision. Yeah, its taxes here on energy companies are not low. It could earn its income another way. It could have a national oil company, but it would be very seen to have a vested interest. With very few exceptions, and there are a few very striking exceptions, national oil companies don't tend to work. They're not efficient, thriving organisations. But there are some very notable exceptions, Petronas, Petrobras, and a few others. It serves Australia very well at the moment that it doesn't have a national oil company. And I think that's one of the reasons why investment levels are so high. And it doesn't just stop with Gorgon. If you look at the LNG projects that are on the rack here, Pluto, for Shell, it's Gorgon, it's Sunrise, hopefully the Browse project. And I'm delighted with the progress we're making on the Prelude project, where we're hopeful of some can use in the future. Each of those is at least $10 billion. And I'm talking about US ones, not Australian ones. Huge levels of investment. One of my questions that I'm continually asked by the board just to, you know, is are the capacities available here, the human capacities? And it's not just in our own company, it's in the service sector here. But believe it or not, boards in Europe and the US think, is there sufficiency of human resource? But I just want to build on a point that was raised earlier on. One of the biggest concerns that those boards have at the moment, one of the biggest questions they have, is the uncertainty around the introduction of the CPRS. It's that uncertainty that's causing them some grief at the moment. But to answer your question, I think it serves you hugely well in this country that you tax us rather than you put a national oil company in there.
We have a next question over here.
George Molteni from Cuth Energy. John, you used the terminology that some of these technologies, alternative energy technologies, are caught in this valley of uncertainty. And of course, Paul, you were depressing in saying how the equity and the debt markets are deserting investments. And, of course, these technologies have got a higher risk profile. So I wanted to ask the panel, what are the type of policy signals that we need from the government to actually drive genuine investment in there? I mean, the government is picking winners. Martin Ferguson said it's not. It's $2.3 billion out of $4.5 into sequestration and $1.3 to solar. If that's not winners, well, I'd like to be one of those rather than the $800 million that sort of covers the rest of the alternative energy sector. So what sort of signals do we need from government to genuinely drive investment?
I think the policies like renewable energy, the target, which actually creates markets and opportunities and for you to fight your way into in lots of ways. But in terms of Matthew Warren's challenge about thinking laterally, part of the challenge is obviously is about where we're going to get the bucks from. And one of the places that still have the bucks, of course, even though significantly less than they used to have, is the super funds. Now, they have a legal responsibility for managing their assets over a long term. But they actually manage more on a much more short-term basis because they haven't had the skills or technologies or whatever they've done that. Now, we did the world's first survey of super funds with the Australian Institute of Superannuation Trustees and had a look at how they manage that. 80% of them know they've got to do better. Only 9% of them have started. But we're actually in there right now talking with a number of them with best practice methodologies about how this means, and that's actually how they need to hedge their risks of investments, because there's a subprime risk as sure as a subprime risk in amongst many of their investments. And so I think there's a space which we'd like to see a lot more attention, and we'll be putting a lot more work as the Climate Institute over time as well.
The geothermal industry is a really good example of why conventional economic sort of principles doesn't apply in this space. Most of the companies involved in this technology listed on the share market to raise equity about 5-6 years ago. It seemed a good idea at the time. They were very successful, but the technology to get it to market and deploy it is expensive. They're drilling 5 kilometre deep holes in hot fractured rocks and conventional geothermal is less expensive but less potent. It's considerable outlay of capital. Now, according to the market, what should happen is they should have raised capital, and if they couldn't keep raising capital, then that would demonstrate that technology wasn't worth pursuing. But we all know that the asset that has been identified in places like the Cooper Basin is substantial. There's no guarantee we can extract it at an affordable price, or that we can extract it at all, but it, intuitively, it's something that's worth pursuing, and in a fairly aggressive way. So, you know, to that end, it's a number of things. First of all, we consider that R&D should be considered in the same way we treat exploration for mineral resources, and we should be freeing up capital from super funds and from venture capital funds, because they should be taking the risks and deploying across a range of technologies, knowing that not all will succeed, some will fail. We think the tax laws need considerable revision to remove impediments, and if anything, to try and stimulate and direct some of these funds towards these technologies. Australia does. I've got also three countries I can think of that potentially could power themselves with clean energy technologies. Brazil, Australia, and maybe Iceland. There's probably a few more. So we have a real responsibility, as much as anything else, to be aggressive developers of these technologies, because if anyone's going to find out the lowest cost way of getting them up to market, it's going to be in Australia.
Thanks. Megan Motto from the Association of Consulting Engineers Australia. My question's on a similar vein to the last question, but turning the attention for a moment to energy efficiency. There's been some talk earlier about the valley of uncertainty, and yet energy efficiency is the one part of the trilogy of the equation that is certain, because we have known technologies that could substantially abate carbon, and it is the low-hanging fruit. But I was very interested in the Minister's conversations previously, saying that they're not about picking winners. And yet it seems in the energy efficiency policy debate, they in fact have gone down a picking winners solution or policy solution in terms of now the pink bats and previously photovoltaic solar panelling. So my question is, in your mind, what policy settings would appropriately drive private sector investment in particular in energy efficiency? I know John and I've worked on a project about green depreciation. What are your thoughts on that as a policy setting to drive incentives in energy efficiency, and what other policy settings would you suggest?
Yeah, we've done a lot of work on this, and I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of this stuff which is there now. There are things such as in the smart grid space, which we actually, in a similar space to some of these other technologies, we actually still a bit of pilot stage and things. The $100 million that was in the budget, I think, is a good thing for that. There is important advances being made in terms of standards for commercial and residential buildings in terms of disclosure of new buildings, but the nut that hasn't been cracked is the existing infrastructure, and green depreciation is one of a range of financial incentives. Now, the talk is that that's costly. There's too much love that's around because basically companies should be doing this anyway, and they'll just hang around for accelerated depreciation or other, all those sorts of things. We think we do need some of those sorts of policies. We need need other financial incentives on top of that. But I guess, yeah, interested in some of the other panellists.
Yeah, I think, look, there's two things have always struck me about energy efficiency. One is, you know, I've been in the industry now for 18 years, I've always heard it and I've never seen it. And the reason for that in our country is twofold. You effectively have a market failure at one level because it's just a bit complicated to go and do, and the reason it's so complicated is because, quite honestly, in our country, at least up until now, power is just so dirt cheap. The second lowest cost power in the world is in your household in Australia. So there's just not a great deal of incentive to do so right now. But if we get, you know, the right signals going through from the CPRS, if we see the investments that we're expecting to see driven by, you know, this, you know, continual acceleration in peak demand, piece by piece that's going to start to come out of our household budgets. But while power represents under 3% of disposable income, which it has over the past 20 years, it's a really tough sell in and of itself. So that being the case, if the market's not going to work for you and we know it's an issue, then you need to go down a path of basically regulating that market. And so the energy efficiency schemes that you're seeing starting to emerge in Victoria and in South Australia, I know that New South Wales is getting ready to wind one up in July this year, and I hear Queensland are on the same path. God help us, four more schemes, and they won't match, you can guarantee it. But it's a start, and I think, you know, the challenge now Peter Garrett's office is to actually corral all those states, you know, knock their heads together and come out with one good scheme that we can all go and pursue and implement in the marketplace. And as you, I'm sure, given your background, you'd be aware, there's a good 5% of demand that can just clip off the top like that, you know, within a matter of years once you've got it up and running in households. But unfortunately, I don't know about you, but I'm still having difficulty getting my kids to run around and turn lights off and, you know, turn back the air conditioner. My wife's hairdryer looks like a hand cannon. Computer in every house.
I'm sure she's very happy to hear it described like that. Matthew, did you have a comment?
Look, I think that the danger with energy efficiency is describing it as one overarching policy framework. It's a highly disaggregated problem. You know, there's energy efficiency in industrial settings, in commercial settings, in residential SMEs versus larger scale commercial, the split incentives problem of owners of buildings have responsibility but the occupiers don't control the most of the key settings to drive energy efficiency. You have the differences between managing peak loads as opposed to just managing constant supply from different products. So they're all different inside each of those settings. So we need to accept that that's highly disaggregated. In terms of the residential space, I think we're going to see that's an early mover as the gentailers move to a change in their business from being a billing and meter
business to being a service provider, because I used to work for the food and grocery sector, and you know what we say about householders is that they're time poor and choice rich, and most people just want this problem fixed, and they don't want, don't mind paying a little bit more or a little bit less, they just want someone to come in and make it all better. And so that will be the role of AGL and its competitors, who will come in, deploy technology, smart meters, you know, solar panels, whatever that is on the go. We'll keep upgrading and developing those technologies. Householders will notice they're paying, buying less electricity, paying a bit more for it, and paying more for this sort of service that's added on top. And as long as it kind of washes out roughly about the same, they'll be happy and we'll keep going. So it won't be this sort of turning off light switches and turning them back on again and plugging your television off and plugging it back in again and that kind of that moral response. It will be done for you, and you'll suddenly think, You'll turn on your computer at night and it'll tell you that your solar panels have generated so much into the grid and you've saved so much here, and you'll kind of feel pleased and in control of everything and then go and watch television, and that's the way it should work.
Michael Porter, Centre Research. I'd just like to make a comment that I think a production tax is basically the same as an emissions trading scheme, except it's not bastardised. Business loves a committee approach because usually they can get an exemption. And I think representing the younger people who aren't here today, who are very happy with Google and technology, and thinking about why John Tamblyn didn't answer the question, I can see a world coming where you have on your fridge your iPhone or your device that tells you what the price of water is at the moment, what the price of electricity is, depending on who you're using, how the appliances are looking, and what your contribution to carbon emissions is. All the energy in the younger generation that's about emissions trading is lost in the emissions trading scheme. There's committees, we have a pink bat lead recovery, we have discussions of people being subsidised ladders today. It's a lot of nonsense. 10 years from now, we'll be sitting around realising that we had a committee-led recovery in terms of economic terms, but we lost the plot in terms of pricing. If you go back to 73 and 79, a lot of engineers and the government were coming up with solutions to the energy crisis. What was the solution? It was to have a market price for oil and gas. I think Shell would agree with that. We had an emissions, if we have an emissions trading scheme, we are moving towards a system of taxation that is buried. So I think what I would like to see the panel discuss at another occasion is how we get the consumers of energy, with all their energies, focused on new devices for so that they know what they're spending and they know how they're contributing to the solution. If we do it in smoke-filled rooms with an emissions trading scheme, we ain't going to get there. It's a comment.
Well, I guess that's a comment without sort of reply in many respects, given where we are up against the break. But does anyone want to make a quick comment about that? Perhaps Matthew?
Just quickly, I'd make the observation, if you think of some of the great innovations of our lifetime, the internet, microwave ovens, mobile phones, we got them because we didn't need them. It's the nature of innovation is it's hard to drive it forwards in the way you want, but you find pleasant surprises going sideways. So it might be the geothermal industry finds accidentally something else far more valuable by the process of exhausting or pursuing its technology. You've got to allow that to happen and expect to be surprised, and that's what we're calling for.